You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show...
Putting out a book like this that seems to have score settling on a personal level while Obama is still in office is possibly unprecedented.
From a former defense secretary's memoirs to the worsening situation in Iraq, we'll review the day's top news stories with Shashank Joshi and James Boyce. Then, is art a good investment? Melanie Gurlis from the Art newspaper is here to explain why it's riskier than you think. And later in the show... Our very own Paul Noble is here to review the holiday season's biggest music releases. All that plus a check-in with our man in Milan and much more. That is Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, starting right now. So lots coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
People who've fled the fighting in South Sudan face conditions verging on the catastrophic, according to relief workers on the ground. It's thought at least 1,000 people have died and 200,000 have been forced from their homes in the months since the violence erupted. Meanwhile, South Sudan's government has rejected rebel calls for an immediate release of detainees after the two sides met briefly for the first time to end fighting that has left the world's newest state on the brink of civil war. The government chief negotiator is Niall Deng Niall.
What has prompted them to come here is that they are facing some difficulties with the other side, which seems to be demanding that before they can have any meaningful discussions, the detainees have to be released. So in their meeting with His Excellency the President, what I just told you is what he told them, that basically he would be happy to set them free as long as the requisite legal processes have taken place.
The Pentagon says the four crew members on a U.S. Air Force helicopter are presumed dead after it crashed in the east of England. The Pave Hawk helicopter was on a routine training exercise when it came down. People were being diverted from the scene as there was live ammunition on board. Well, Superintendent Roger Wiltshire is from the Norfolk Police.
We believe that there is some ammunition on board the helicopter. We have experts who are about to undertake the assessment to ensure that it is made safe before we undertake any investigation work that we need to do.
Staying here, a more heavy rain is due to hit parts of the United Kingdom today, bringing a risk of further flooding to already saturated areas. Oxfordshire in southeastern England is one of the worst affected regions, with heavy rain over previous days leading to widespread flooding. More than 100 flood warnings are currently in place in England, Scotland and Wales. So far, 7 people have died and more than 1,700 homes and businesses have been flooded in England alone since the beginning of the Christmas period, with around 550 properties flooded since the new year. Around 140 properties have been flooded in Wales. Britain's insurers are preparing to pay out hundreds of millions of pounds in claims following a run of winter storms. More weather news now, and people on the east coast of North America are starting another day with record low temperatures. At least 6 deaths have been reported across the country due to the polar air mass sweeping over North America, producing the coldest temperatures in 2 decades. On Tuesday, every US state recorded sub-zero temperatures, including normally warm Florida, California, and Hawaii. Today, temperatures are expected to be 25 degrees to 35 degrees Fahrenheit below normal from the Midwest to the Southeast, the National Weather Service said. The lowest recorded temperature, minus 35 Fahrenheit, that's minus 37 Celsius, was in Minnesota. Well, Monocle's transport editor is Tristan McAllister.
These events, these weather events, are planned for every year in the U.S. So that is not a deal breaker for these airlines. In the case of JetBlue, concentrated at their hubs where they have to slow down a majority of their operations, definitely hurts them more than others. In terms of pilots, mostly these airlines have accounted for this. They're ready for it.
And finally, everyone in Norway became a theoretical crown millionaire on Wednesday in a milestone for the world's biggest sovereign wealth fund that has ballooned thanks to high oil and gas prices. Set up in 1990, the fund owns around 1% of the world's stocks, as well as bonds and real estate from London to Boston, making the Nordic nation an exception and Norwegians individually very rich when others are struggling under a mountain of debts. And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you for the news, Jonathan Wheatley. Indeed, when it comes to all that oil money in Norway, actually, I was in Oslo not that long time ago.
Really?
And you do realise that there is a lot of money in the country when you see the prices over there.
So if it's 10 kroners to the pound, that makes them have about £100,000 each. That's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
It's quite extraordinary. And you know what? Like, the prices are reflected. I'm quite surprised, actually. No one was too angry at me when I actually took a cab from the airport to get to central Oslo, because that was rather expensive.
Was it really?
It was, yeah. Mm. Let's not talk more about that. Jonathan's going to be back with more news headlines in about 25 minutes here on Monocle 24. You are listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06 and it is 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Dr. James Boyce, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme. Let's start in Washington, where former Defence Secretary Robert Gates has sharply criticised President Obama in his new memoir. According to Gates, Obama lacked enthusiasm for the US mission in Afghanistan. He also criticizes Joe Biden's foreign policy instinct, saying that he was wrong on nearly every major foreign policy and national security issue over the past four decades. Well, a bit earlier we asked our Washington DC correspondent Sasha Eisenberg what he thought.
He sort of suggests Obama wasn't fully invested in the war in Afghanistan, yet doesn't entirely explain why then Obama persisted in doing things that were relatively unpopular and, by Gates' own admission, overrode a lot of his political advisors within the White House to support them, and does seem sort of mixed in both the praise and criticism of Hillary Clinton, for example. I think people are very surprised by the fact that Gates would do this and the timing. Gates has always been seen as a very sort of discreet company man, and putting out a book like this that seems to have score settling on a personal level while Obama is still in office is possibly unprecedented. These are often the types of things that come out when somebody has left, but to do it in the middle of his second term, I think, sort of surprises people.
That was Monocle's Washington, D.C. correspondent Sasha Eisenberg on today's edition of The Briefing. Well, Shashank Joshi and James Boyce, do you think Gates' criticisms are fair?
Well, I think they're somewhat confused, actually. I think his worst criticism is directed at the cynicism of Washington. I think he says at the end of one of his chapters how much he detests the job. And he senses that the White House is controlling, is micromanaging, is meddling. But some of his worst criticism is reserved not only for Congress, also for the National Security Advisor, for the Vice President, rather than Obama per se. I also think, as your correspondent alluded to, he doesn't actually say what he would have done in Afghanistan. I think if you read it between the lines, he's irritated at the fact that Obama set a withdrawal date. That seems to be the focus of his criticism. But of course, what he doesn't seem to mention is that he himself, along with everyone else, signed on to the strategy, literally signed a piece of paper with the strategy on it. And in addition to that, that this was a compromise between Obama and his military generals. And I think he's somewhat exculpating the military top brass, who also could have said, look, we can't do this with a surge of only 30,000.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about this is that if you look at what Gates is saying, nobody comes out of this well at all, except, of course, Bob Gates. If you look at the piece that he's put in the Wall Street Journal, for example, you know, one wonders about his mental state of mind to a certain degree. It opens with starting this thing, I was sitting in front of Congress and I was fuming about this and the other and I wanted to quit on the spot. And it does seem a little bit juvenile in many places. Now, hey, you know, maybe that's Gates' way, but I think what this does do... I was reading this, I kept thinking about, within a British context, when Geoffrey Howe resigned from the government and the idea that, you know, the Prime Minister of the day has to sit there and take it effectively in the House of Commons. Well, in the United States, of course, famously, the appointees serve at the pleasure of the president. They don't resign historically. It's very, very rare that they do so. But what they can do is they don't get their own back in the House of Commons necessarily, but they do in their memoirs. And I think what's important to recognise is this is part of Gates's attempt to sell the book, and I think he's probably going to do quite well as a result of that.
Savaged by a dead sheep.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think it's interesting. That's very true. It's amusing, actually, that when people write their memoirs, they are quite often, for some reason, the ones who have always been right.
More often than not.
When you look at the publicity this book has been getting already, do you
Can
think...
I just say one thing? We should give Gates a little credit on acknowledging, I think, that Obama made an exceptionally courageous decision, as he calls it, the most courageous that Gates says he had seen in the White House. And don't forget, this is a man who served every president since Nixon, apart from Clinton, in the Abbottabad raid for bin Laden. And Gates is pretty honest. He got that one wrong, he says.
Exactly. Do you think all this publicity is going to affect President Obama somehow?
Well, ultimately, don't forget, what's it going to do? I mean, the guy is beyond the will of the voters now. He's not going to seek re-election. It's not really going to have a big knock-on effect, I would imagine, detrimentally. It's not going to do him any great things within the Washington intelligentsia. But I don't really think that, you know, how many people are really going to read this book within the United States, outside of Washington, D.C. And New York, perhaps? It's going to be something which people or look at the headlines and think, ooh, that's kind of interesting. And the focus upon Obama is interesting because, of course, as we were saying earlier on, the piece in the Wall Street Journal and the book itself goes far beyond that to criticise, amongst other things, you know, President Bush, et cetera, et cetera, and the whole apparatus of Congress. So really, it really is a plague on every house, I think, in Washington.
But it will affect, perhaps not Obama, but Hillary Clinton, who is criticised as admitting that her opposition to the surge in Iraq was purely political in 2007. And I think that little fact, that little admission is going to come back and bite her. It will be used repeatedly as a talking point by Republicans in 2016. Absolutely no doubt about that.
What kind of response are you expecting, say, from Hillary Clinton or from White House?
I think a very quiet one. They have a lot of respect for Bob Gates. He's not some sort of, you know, when Vali Nasser, who was a special advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrook, resigned, he wrote a big tell-all book, fiercely critical along many of the same lines. And the administration hit back, I think, pretty hard, arguing against his ideas. But Vali Nasser wasn't a heavyweight in the same way, I think, that Bob Gates is a bipartisan heavyweight, whose nickname was Yoda in the beginning of the administration. You don't go savage Yoda back, I think. So I think their response will be low-key, measured, and they will ride the wave.
Let's move now to Iraq, where Al-Qaeda threat is forcing the Obama administration to consider ways to expand its support there. What are you expecting?
Profoundly little. There's been already shipments of unarmed surveillance drones and some missiles going to the Iraqis since last year. They were trying to accelerate them at Christmas. That's about all it's going to be. The administration wants to be very, very careful. Some people want to send Apache helicopters and F-16s to Iraq, but Congress is wary. Congress is worried about how Maliki, the Prime Minister of Iraq, may use these against his opponent. And I think the balance they have to strike is how do we help the Iraqis combat al-Qaeda in Anbar province without also encouraging him to think there is no political solution and he can bomb his way out of this?
There's no doubt about it. If you think that Obama didn't want to be in Afghanistan, he certainly didn't want to be in Iraq. You know, one of the first things he pledged to do was to get out of Iraq. He managed to manipulate the Iraq war quite well, I think, during the election for his own purposes, got elected, and managed to withdraw on a nice timetable ahead of his re-election campaign. But he certainly didn't want to be in Iraq. He didn't want to be in Afghanistan. And he certainly won't be doing anything to get back involved in Iraq anytime soon.
But it is embarrassing because, you know, these were cities, Fallujah, Ramadi, that were taken at enormous cost, not just to Iraqis, obviously, but also to really significant American cost. There were some of the most bloody battles fought by the Americans, I think, since Vietnam. So this is really embarrassing for the White House.
It is, but don't forget also something else to add to this. You know, the Obama administration doesn't want to be back in there, but I doubt the Iraqis want them back in there because, of course, there was a retraction of the original agreement, which would have kept American forces and country that George W. Bush had signed with al-Maliki, which was then basically revoked once Obama came into office.
So when Obama administration is thinking about maybe doing something, maybe somehow expanding the support, quite realistically, what are the options?
Well, there's already lots of CIA people in Iraq basically helping the Iraqis target al-Qaeda. Right now, they're using these turboprop Cessnas, not the famed drones we hear about. They're using old Cessna turboprops with missiles strapped to the bottom, firing at al-Qaeda with CIA assistance for targeting. What they're now getting from the Americans is new drones, particularly Scan Eagle drones that can help them look at the street-to-street fighting going on in these really difficult urban combat environments like the city of Fallujah, the city of Anbar. They'll also receive more Hellfire missiles. They may or may not receive more intelligence. That's as far as it will go. I think beyond that, there are very, very few politically viable options for the United States to do anything. And one thing, we talk about al-Qaeda, but we need to be careful here. What's going on in Anbar in Iraq is not just al-Qaeda, as if everyone's a member of the organization formerly headed up by bin Laden. These are lots of these guys are local tribesmen. Lots of these guys are local Islamists. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I don't think the Americans see this as a major pressing direct threat to the U.S. homeland right now.
Exactly. U.S. officials have said that they are in discussions with the Iraqi government about possibly training its elite forces in a third country. What would that exactly mean?
Well, that's going to be the main thing, isn't it? The idea that no one's going to want to get boots on the ground again. I think the challenge here is the United States have withdrawn. They've made that decision to get out. No one's in any great rush politically, economically or militarily to get back involved. Can I really see them training Iraqi forces in a third party country? Which country would that be?
Jordan, I imagine.
Possibly. Yeah. But, that does seem logistically quite problematic, I would have thought. And getting congressional support for that as well. I think all too often we look at this and think, well, what are Obama going to do? Well, Obama, as has been revealed over the last 12 months, is not a particularly courageous commander-in-chief. He's someone who is quite cautious, very conservative in some respects. And when push comes to shove, I think that he will say, well, I could do this, but I'll need congressional support for it. And that will not be forthcoming. So once again, I think he'll be able to hide behind the skirts of Congress to basically stay out of a situation he does not want to get involved in.
What do you think? What exactly does Washington want from Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government?
Well, at a broad level, it wants political reconciliation. It wants Maliki to be less sectarian, less divisive, less vindictive towards his country's Sunni minority population, to be more careful in how it treats senior Sunni politicians. It wants Maliki generally to rule less like a sectarian autocrat. It also wants him to stop allowing Iranian overflights of arms to Syria. It wants him to act more independently. On a more specific level, it wants constitutional changes that would see oil revenues allocated more fairly to Sunni provinces. So there's a whole list of things. Does the White House think it'll get any of that? I very much doubt it.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with Markus Hippi. Shashank Joshi and James Boyce will still be here when we return. And up next, we'll talk Syria. Stay tuned.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and ask the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has the right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is 22:20 in Moscow, 18:20 here in London, 13:20 if you're listening in Washington, D.C. Still with me is Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at RUSI, and Dr. James Boyce, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London. Let's move now to Syria, where the Western-backed Syrian opposition still hasn't decided whether it will attend the Geneva II peace talks or not. The peace conference is scheduled to start in Montreux on January 22nd. Shashank, what do you think? What's going on with the opposition here?
Which opposition? I mean, it's just insane. I used to compare it to Monty Python and People's Front of Judea versus Judean People's Front, but it's even worse than that, because you look this week, the Syrian National Coalition is the umbrella group that we all know and love. But within that, do you remember the old umbrella group, the Syrian National Council? That never disbanded. That's just within the Syrian National Coalition. So the Syrian National Council, this subordinate group, has said if its parent organization goes to Montreux, it will step out. So, I mean, you have an incredible situation where there's no coherence from the coalition. And then on top of that, you have to remember the coalition has no relevance on the ground. It has no connection to the various brigades fighting even as part of the FSA. And then you have to remember even the FSA has no relevance to most of the rebellion, which is now dominated by Salafis, notably the Islamic Front, a big coalition of seven other groups. And then on top of that, and this is my final one, I promise, the Islamic Front is itself now in absolutely intense battles with the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, ISIS, in other words, al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is now fighting in Syria. So good luck getting even step one in my big chain to Montreux, let alone the other four elements.
You make it sound like it doesn't really matter if someone is going to go there or not.
Well, what can they do? What can they promise? They can promise anything they like, but will the people with the guns, the many people with the guns, listen to whatever outcome they commit to?
Exactly. And what is the view from Assad's government at the moment? How willing is it to send its representatives to the conference?
Well, it seems that they're likely to be there. Certainly more likely, I think, than the other side. But there's, you know, one of the problems you've got with this is if you are within the Syrian government, why would you go? Why would you partake in this? Because it seems that, for example, the Americans are not happy with the Iranians. They don't want the Iranians there for many reasons. But one of the reasons they don't want the Iranians there is because the Iranians won't basically agree up front that there should be a transfer of power within Syria. So if you're the Syrian delegation, you're going to say, well, why would I go to a conference which is basically preordained to get away with myself, well,
I think
my leaders,
etc.,
etc.?
I think there are reasons to go to a clown show, which is that if your opponents look like they're an absolute mess, you look like the reasonable ones. And at this point, my view is that the Syrian government will turn up. Russia will pressure it to turn up because the outcome is so unlikely to yield anything like a transition, even though, of course, as you rightly point out, that is the principle of the peace conference. Why not? What do you have to lose?
It's a good idea. I think it's always a bad sign when you can start comparing one of these organizations and conferences to Monty Python. I think that basically says an awful lot up front about how much of a clown show this is rightly going to be. And I couldn't agree with you more, quite frankly.
It's interesting that Iran, which has strongly backed Assad's government, would actually really like to join the peace talks. How probable do you think it is that Iran is going to get the invitation?
Well, so far they haven't been. What is interesting about this coming out is that it's understood that there is an approved list which has been invited. They're not saying who's on that list at this point. They're suggesting, for example, Iran isn't, and that the list has to be agreed by the Americans and the Russians, for example. I think the Russians would obviously like them to be there. The Americans almost certainly won't, for many reasons, most of which are political, I'd suggest. I'd say at the moment, on balance, the chances are I don't think they'll be there, but they might have a role to play in the outside, effectively. But whether they'll be happy enough with that, I doubt personally.
Well, a bit earlier, we asked Iranian political analyst Mirat Vezinajad for his thoughts on Iranian involvement in the peace talks.
They have shown before that they have a lot of influence on Bashar Assad's regime, and that's one side of it. The other side is a lot of the fighters are not from the Syrian regime, but people from Hezbollah, for example, or other Shia groups, which I think no one but Iran has influence over them. So if they're included in process, if they agree to some sort of broad political, let's say, solution, they might be able to actually contain those groups and help ending their fighting for the moment, then to find a political end game.
That was Mirat Vezinajad there. Shershan, just before this clip, you were trying to say something, and I'm going to ask the next question from you. Do you think, will it actually make a difference if Iran joins the talks?
Possibly. They have indeed shown some influence. They were influential in the US-Russian agreement for Syria to dispose of its chemical weapons. They played a part in the surroundings of that. I mean, the fact remains, they're not opposed to transition. They, like all parties, just want transition on their own terms. And right now, as James, I think, pointed out earlier on, those terms diverge from the ones the Americans want, which are the process, when we all get around the table, everyone has to be agreed, it will ultimately lead to a movement away from Assad. The Russians have formally agreed that, although maybe not in substance, maybe not in practice. The Iranians aren't willing to say that out loud. But if you have them at the table, I think you don't lose anything by talking to people. That's always my view on diplomacy. And I think you can get a rough sense of, look, if there is transition, you can speak to them on the sidelines of the conference. What level of Syrian security forces do you want to see? Which individuals do you think are red lines for you who must stay in a Syrian regime? Which ones can go? These kind of informal back channel discussions between Americans, Russians, Iranians, these are useful things to do.
I couldn't agree more on that point with regards to whether Iran should be there. I think the big problem is not what Shashank and I think would be right in terms of whether you should talk to these people. The challenge, I think, has been that in Washington, D.C. for too long, there has been too much of a preponderance of a concept that we don't talk to our enemies, we only talk to our friends, at least openly. There's no doubt that there has been back channels to Tehran for a great number of years, but to come out and openly say, come along. That would be, I think, taking that relationship to a new level, which I don't think at this point the Obama administration is prepared to do.
And moving on to the last topic today, at the same time, Syria has started to move its chemical weapons materials out of its borders following the internationally backed disarmament program. The original deadline was in the end of 2013, but that was missed due to bureaucracy and technical issues, supposedly. James, how well do you think this program has worked out?
Well, I don't think we can really blame the Syrian regime too much for missing a deadline by a matter of days, considering they're in the midst of a civil war at this point. There is mitigating circumstances. I think that we have seen that process begin. Destruction has already commenced. Shipment of this material has begun. I think Putin's played a blinder in this. I don't think the administration in Washington's come out particularly well. But if it starts to see a destruction of chemical weapons, then all the better, quite frankly.
How much is known at the moment of how much of Syria's total chemical arsenal has actually been moved this far?
A very small amount. It begins with the precursors, that is, the stuff you mix together to make the chemical, the precursors for the worst weapons, the VX and the sarin. A small proportion has been moved so far. We'll see how it goes. They'll see how safe it is to transport this to Latakia. They seem to have done the first batch. That will continue. You know, what matters really is not so much whether this is all done by the summer. I think what matters much more is whether the worst stuff is eliminated quickly and whether there are any issues of compliance. That is, if the first allegation turns up that Syria is hiding anything, it doesn't matter if you ship out 99%, 99.5%, a single credible allegation from the Israelis, the Syrians, the Israelis, the Americans, anyone, that Syria is hiding stuff, will be back to the same situation we were in with Saddam Hussein in the 1990s or with respect to Iran in the 2000s. And that will be a political storm.
And how can we avoid that political storm, considering that there's really no way of being absolutely sure.
You get your intelligence right. So the thing that gives me confidence is that the Americans and the Russians at the beginning of this process sat down and said, here's what we think the Syrians have. And they agreed. And that was the big moment, because of course they each had incentive not to give the true figures. They might pass them on to someone else. You monitor Syria carefully. You have a lot of intelligence, signals intelligence. You have satellite coverage. You have human intelligence. You enlist the Israelis, and you do that to make sure that you have your bases covered. Because if a dissident group comes out, the rebels come out and say, "Aha, we found a new facility," you're politically screwed.
I think there's one difference here, and I agree with everything you said. The difference here, I think, though, is that there is not a preponderance of wanting to go into this country militarily on behalf of the United States. They're not looking for an entry point. They're not looking for non-compliance. Yeah. And I think, actually, you've got the exact opposite.
We'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, already. Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Dr. James Boyce, Senior Visiting Fellow at King's College London. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Milan. We'll find out why art is a riskier investment than you think. And we even review the latest music tracks with Paul Noble. But before we get started with all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. People who fled the fighting in South Sudan face conditions verging on the catastrophic, according to relief workers on the ground. It's thought at least 1,000 people have now died and 200,000 have been forced from their homes in the month since the violence erupted. The Pentagon says the four crew members on a US Air Force helicopter are presumed dead after it crashed in East Anglia, that's in the east of England. The Pave Hawk helicopter was on a routine training exercise when it came down. Staying here, a more heavy rain is due to hit parts of the United Kingdom today, bringing a risk of further flooding to already saturated areas. More than 100 flood warnings are currently in place in England, Scotland and Wales. So far, 7 people have died and more than 1,700 homes and businesses have been flooded in England. More weather news, and people on the east coast of the United States, particularly Canada as well, are starting another day with record low temperatures. At least 6 deaths have already been reported across the USA due to the polar air mass sweeping across North America, producing the coldest temperatures in 2 decades. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 22:31 in Moscow, 18:31 here in London, and 16:31 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today we head to Milan, where our correspondent there, Ivan Cavallo, joins us on the line. Welcome to the programme, Ivan. Shall we start with Italy's domestic politics? Centre-left Prime Minister Enrico Letta is meeting with centre-right coalition partner Angelino Alfano and Matteo Renzi, Florence Mayer, Party Secretary of Democratic Party as well. What is expected from these talks?
Yeah, good evening, Marcus. The talks this week, Letta is looking ahead for 2014 to put more reforms on the table for Italy's economy, which numbers just came out. Unemployment is now again at another record high. We're almost at 13%. So there are certain policy reforms they want to take look at, and also the electoral law reform, which is what we've been talking about in recent weeks on these programs, is that they need to overhaul the electoral law, which was struck down by Italy's courts. And Renzi, for example, has put out a few proposals recently about what he thinks Italy should be when voters go to the polls in terms of how they should vote.
If we look at the economic reforms, what are the most talked about?
Well, Renzi, who is now the party secretary and is sort of standing behind Enrico Letta, you know, it's still unclear whether, you know, he's ready to take his job away or not. Renzi says just recently, yesterday, in fact, on TV, that he was going to rerun for mayor of Florence. But he's been pushing this, what he calls a job act, And up to now, it's unclear some of the measures he wants to put through. He's like about doing some taxes on financial gains to give back, but it's still something where it's a lot of semantics. You know, this word jawback, it sounds kind of sexy to the voters, but it's still unclear about how he's going to bring down that record unemployment level.
How easy is it for Enrico Letta to push through this kind of new reforms?
Well, I mean, he has a slimmer majority now that Angelino Alfano split away from Berlusconi on the center right. But he has some wiggle room to maneuver, and Renzi is saying that he's going to give him time, up to a year and a half to put through some reforms. So, if Letta can get this new CD, this new center right party of Alfano together, and some of the centrists, we may be able to see some reforms taking place that will ease the burden on the Italian economy and obviously the taxpayers, because they're still feeling a very high tax burden right now.
Let's continue with retail. Men's fashion trade fair Pitti Uomo is currently taking place in Florence, and Men's Fashion Week starts in Milan this weekend. What is the retail mood in Italy like at the moment?
Well, the good thing is that foreigners are coming in and buying, and Italy is exporting to these foreign markets. Menswear is now up to about almost 9 billion euros, but it's all thanks to exports, because the Italian economy is, in terms of internal market, the consumption has contracted upwards of 5%. But on the rebound, exports have helped to push figures into the positive. So overall, the menswear market is growing. And Pitti Uomo in Florence is the biggest really menswear fair in the world. You have to be there. I mean, over 1,000 brands are there showing collections for now next winter. So looking at 2014-2015 winter collections.
How much excitement is there around Pitti Uomo and Men's Fashion Week this year?
It's pretty positive. I have to say that you see, for example, in Milan, there are also people getting ready for the shows, and lots of foreigners are coming in. There's buyers now, whereas say 10 years ago you didn't see as much. Buyers from these so-called emerging markets were now a bit more mature markets coming in to play from Asia, Turkey, even South America, who are looking to buy good quality Italian menswear.
The sales in Italy are slightly different from what you can see, say, in the UK or in the US. The sales periods are quite strictly regulated by the government. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, there are periods of discounting. So whereas, say, in the US, you always see discounting, at least in my recent travels to the US to visit family, you should see department stores slashing prices all the time. Right after Christmas, there is not this rush, what you see also in the UK, to the stores. The local governments have a sales period that they instate, and they say it can only begin at a certain time, and they stagger it between different cities. The merchants want to liberalize this, and what you see actually now, because of the poor economy, people have been sort of quietly discounting ahead of time, even before Christmas. I've seen this in shops in Milan. The sales period, again, this sort of reflects the Italian economy. Internal consumption, the Italian consumers are not buying, so everyone's hoping for, again, the foreign tourists. And this year, you see a lot of Russians, Arabs, Koreans getting in there and getting all those nice fashion brands that we know Italy makes.
How much is being done currently to make the shopping experience nicer for these people who are coming into Italy from abroad, say, when it comes to the language skills of sales assistants?
Yeah, this is something interesting. I was recently traveling for work in Dubai, and there's a market where, Dubai is now living on shopping and tourism and not energy reserves. And you see, it's quite amazing. I was very impressed in my brief time going around some of these shopping malls. And it, of course, everything, the customers are treated very well, and the English is, of course, the lingua franca. I've noticed that in Milan, it's quite interesting that still the language skills about catering to some of these customers. I mean, yes, there have been some Chinese, Russian speakers brought in as sales clerks, but I think, and this has been talked about also by the city council, is that they need to do a bit more, because they have to be more welcoming, and it's also for the bottom line for retailers, because having that customer who understands better when they're talking about fabrics and how to clean products, it might help them to increase the sales. So it's something that I think Italy is a bit behind on.
Before I let you go, Ivan, shall we talk about a new ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that may change the policy of naming children in Italy?
Yeah, this is something, this is, you know, Italy, very traditional, patriarchal, as, you know, sometimes it's seen from the outside world, where the parents cannot choose to give their baby the mother's maiden name. And recently, there was a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that struck down this Italian law. And these parents in Milan have been trying since 1999, when their baby girl was born, to change this practice. And it's something that even the Italy's constitutional court was saying it's an outmoded thing that dates back to Roman times, but they said they couldn't do anything about it. They said Parliament would have to do something about it. So right now this European ruling has come through, and interestingly, Enrico Letta, the Prime Minister, tweeted that he was in favor of this. So you know, if Parliament doesn't make a change on this, it's something that they, you know, that they might be looking to do this year, because the European Court's giving Italy 3 months to appeal on this.
Thank you, Ivan. That was Monocle's correspondent in Milan, Ivan Cavallo. Up next, we'll ask if art is such a good investment. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
In 2014, The Foreign Desk is coming to Monocle 24. Interviews with presidents and prime ministers, reports from the front line, the debates, the arguments, the analysis on the world's most important stories.
There are two conventional wisdoms in Europe at the moment. The first is that the far right will dominate and be very successful at the European elections. And the second is that the far right is on the rise across Europe generally. We need to correct those two assumptions.
My hope would be that the new government in China feels sufficiently secure next year that they can ease up a little bit on the rather worrisome repressive tendencies.
Every Saturday at 12 noon in London, and available for download all week on Monocle.com, iTunes and SoundCloud.
This is a challenge, to give them the knowledge, to give them the hope for the future that they can reintegrate into society, believe that they can get a job, get them to decouple from criminal activities, and we have more to do when it comes to these matters.
I'm Steve Bloomfield. This is The Foreign Desk. Join us from Saturday, the 11th of January.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. We continue with a look at art as an investment. Our next guest argues in her new book that despite common perception, art is pretty much one of the riskiest forms of investment. Melanie Gurley's art market editor at the Art newspaper is here in the studio with me. Welcome to the program. So I just thought it's easy to assume that the value of art is in a never-ending rise, because you, when you follow the media, when you follow the news, almost every week there are news stories that new record prices have been made in art auctions. What do you think, what exactly is the problem with art as an investment?
Well, I think it's a lovely thing to buy if you like it, but you're only going to see the good news, because it's in the interest of the people who are selling to promote the good news. You're not going to hear when something doesn't sell. And my point in my book, I compare art to six other investments, some of which are traditional, like gold or stocks and shares, and some of which are alternative, like private equity or even wine. And when you compare art market or art, owning art, to these other ones, it's so much more risky. So the chance of selling something for double, there's always a chance, but the chance of selling it for nothing is also a very big chance, and I think people don't realise that.
How well can the general rules of finance be applied in art?
I fear not as well as people would like. And I came into this art world from the world of finance, and my first thought was, of course, we can trade art like you trade commodities, but you forget that art is not a commodity. Every single piece of art is different, and even if two pieces of art are the same, so you get two photographs from the same series, one of them could come from an important seller and therefore be worth more, one of them could not. There is no consistency.
So it's not just about the artwork itself, it's about the history, it's about the story and everything that's been happening to it during the years.
Exactly, and I think that's the thing people don't realise, that there is no real way of measuring exactly what a photograph or a painting or a sculpture is worth. It could also be about, you know, so there are studies that have been done that show that people spend a wee bit more when the sun shines. So there are things completely out of your control.
So if you have to kind of know more about the piece of work, what if you do your research very well? Do you think that's going to make investing in art a safer option?
You certainly have to do the bare minimum of research not to get burned. But I think the other problem is, in a way, there's almost nothing an individual can do to break into the world where the really, really big money is made, because you need to be a dealer. You need to be in the know. You need to know how often a work of art, for example, if a work of art has been offered lots of times around the market, it will be worth less. But as a normal person going to auction, seeing it coming up, you can research the artist, you can research where it's been on display. You're not going to know how many times privately that painting has been up for sale.
I was just going to ask you next how transparent the art market is. It doesn't sound like it is very much so at all.
That's exactly. And that's the biggest problem, really. There's no transparency on pricing. There's no transparency on anything, really. Because in a way, for the market to work, some people need to know more than others.
Is it in anyone's interest to make the market more transparent?
That's exactly the point. It's not in the interest of traders. So the auction houses do their best, and are more public than private dealers. But no, it's not in anyone's interest. If I know something that you don't know, then I can make more money than you.
And you won't tell. How well do you think people investing in art generally understand the risks they are taking?
Well, I'm sure people are know they're taking more of a risk. But I think people don't. They like to think they're smart. And obviously the reason I wrote the book was because I wanted to explain to people that perhaps it's not all is not as it seems. It seems to me people are quite happy to go headlong into buying art when, if they buy anything else, they seem to take much more time.
So what would you suggest if you speak to a potential investor trying to decide whether to put money into art or not? What should this person take into account?
I mean, what everyone always says is buy what you like. I'm not sure how true that is. There are two schools of thought. One is buy the best of whatever category. So if you are going to buy an impressionist work, buy the best Monet from, you know, the 1870s or so forth. But maybe that is out of your price range. The alternative would be to go and, you know, maybe buy the opposite. Buy something that is arguably undervalued and not very fashionable. You know, about 5 years ago, pre-Raphaelite art wasn't very fashionable, and now it is.
But how do you know what is undervalued?
Well, I mean, that is the question. You have to look at what prices you can look at. So if you can look at the prices of art on a database that is sold at auction, and remember, you can only look at prices from auction, so you're only seeing half the market. And you know you have to take the best guess. You have to ask an expert.
Thank you very much for that. That was Melanie Gurley's art market editor at The Art newspaper, whose book Art as an Investment, A Survey of Comparative Assets, is out soon. Thank you very much indeed. It's time now for a bit of music here on Monocle 24. Let's stay on track with the art theme. This is Charlotte Gainsbourg with Le Chat du Café des Artistes. 2051 in Helsinki, 1851 in London, 1351 in New York City. What we just heard was Charlotte Gainsbourg with Le Chat du Café des Artistes. You're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24. We are fast approaching the end of the program, but before we go, it's time for our daily review segment where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. Today, we talk music. Monaco producer and music consultant Paul Noble joins me here in the studio. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Marcus. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I heard that you are kind of slightly in a festive mood. There's someone's birthday today, right?
It's true. It's David Bowie's birthday. He's 67 today. We couldn't do a music segment without mentioning probably, you know, the man of the decade. He came back roaring back last year. No one saw it coming. He just suddenly sprung an album on us. And there was the exhibition at the V&A. There was the ad for Louis Vuitton, which I could have lived without. I don't think he needed to do it, but yeah, happy birthday, Dave.
Have you got any idea, will we be hearing lots more of David Bowie during the following years, or is he going to take another similar ridiculously long break?
Who knows? It's you know, it's good that he's back to health, because he did have a few years where people were sort of written him off, and it looks like he's, you know, he's got the appetite for producing once again. So that's good. And what I wanted to bring up is this idea of suddenly springing an album on your public out of nowhere, which we saw done in a fantastic style at the end of last year by Beyonce, everyone's favourite globe-straddling megastar. Once everyone had put their best of 2013 list to bed and, you know, wrapped up their end-of-year specials, she suddenly, from nowhere, sprang a fantastic album out right before Christmas. They called it a visual album. It's 14 tracks and 17 videos. No one saw it coming. She just did it.
That's something. I've been trying to count so many times how many individuals have been participating in this album project, this video project, and how on earth it's been possible that no one has leaked the information.
None of them leaked
of what
it.
She is going to do.
She must have signed, or they must have signed, some very scary NDAs in the process. The interesting thing about this album is it's 80% of it is produced by a guy called Boots. Now, who is Boots?
Does anyone know?
No one knows. Well, he's a guy called Jodie Asher, and he's done a few bits and bobs before. But, you know, the biggest pop star in the world. She's obviously got Timbaland and Pharrell and all the usual suspects who you'd find on an album. But Boots' handprints are all over this album. So, you know, good on him for coming out of nowhere.
Have you heard from anywhere how Beyonce spotted this guy, or how this guy spotted Beyonce?
I've got no idea how they started. He's soundtracked a couple of fashion shows, and she must have seen him through her fashion world connections. But yeah, how did they keep it a secret? And it's also quite uncommercial. It's quite low key. It's quite trendy. She's obviously taking a few cues from her hipster sister, Solange.
Exactly. Do you think two very interesting examples over here? David Bowie, kind of surprise comeback, and same way Beyonce. Do you think this is something we're going to be seeing ever more in the future?
It would be good, wouldn't it? Because I think the whole dragged out, you know, process of hyping up an album, which we saw with Lady Gaga, who spent about 6 months telling the world that she's married art and pop for the first time ever. No one's ever thought of it. I bet Bjork and Bowie and Kate Bush and all sorts of others would be fascinated to hear that.
Talking about Lady Gaga, by the way, what did you think about the album, The Final Marriage Between Pop and Art?
I mean, I'm not a fan of hers to begin with, so I'm not the person to talk about. But I know it's been a massive underperformer for the label. She's sold just over 250,000 albums, which...
That is incredibly little.
Yeah, that's not a lot. I mean, the label will be looking at a big loss, and she had a Christmas special with the Muppets, and she's doing a duets album with Tony Bennett, so she's going to try and claw back her little monsters.
Well, there's an album you've been particularly excited about recently. Do you want to talk about that?
It's by a band called Lord Echo.
Who are they?
Lord Echo, they are from New Zealand. This album was given to me by DJ Satoshi, who's our friend from Japan who flies in whenever we do our events here at Monocle House. And it's somewhere between sort of reggae, dub, afrobeat. It's a little bit spacey. It's on a label called Jakarta Records. Do you want to guess where they're from?
Jakarta.
Cologne in Germany. You got that right. And I've just been listening. It's just a really satisfying, lovely, warm album. I've been listening to it all over Christmas.
I'm looking at the clock, you know. I think we have about 2 minutes of time to listen to that actual song you've been talking about.
Yeah, this is one of the more Afrobeat sort of Fela Kuti style tracks on the album. This is called What Is That Feeling?
Lord Echo there with What Is That Feeling, a song recommended by Monocle producer and music consultant Paul Noble. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests Shashank Joshi, research fellow at RUSI, and Dr. James Boyce from King's College London. Today's show was produced by Daniel Ciacopelli, researched by Alexa Firmanish and Hayley Jo Lott, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next after the headlines is The Entrepreneurs, where our correspondent Barrett Austin meets designer Sid Mashburn. Here is a taste of that chat.
Optimism is huge for us. I don't think you can ever underestimate the importance of optimism in helping drive a business like this.
Then at 2200 hours London time, that's in 3 hours, we have the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it is goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Tells the story of a passion for motor racing, a legend forged over time by the pioneers of speed and great drivers. The Daytona Cosmograph, the watch made to break barriers, the watch dedicated to endurance, the watch that was born to race. Rolex.